This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Frank Luntz, is a pollster who advises politicians on the language they should use to win elections and promote their policies. He helped develop the language to sell the Republicans' Contract with America in 1994. During the impeachment of President Clinton, he wrote weekly strategic language memos for Trent Lott's advisory group. He says in the past 10 years, he's worked behind the scenes in debate prep sessions and TV network green rooms, in the halls of Congress and in state capitals across the country, advising Republican senators and congressmen on issues of language. Although he works on one side of the aisle, he says that what he does is essentially nonpartisan, seeking clarity and simplicity in language. His critics disagree and have accused him of using language that spins and misrepresents policies to sway public opinion. Lately, Luntz has been working for candidates in other countries and consulting with corporations. His new book is called Words That Work. Frank Luntz, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me just start by asking you to describe your work.
I've always been fascinated with language, with the power of words to convince, to anger, to soothe. And my job is to figure out the words, the language that the American people respond to, that they relate to, that they understand, words that are credible, words that motivate people. And through focus groups, polling, online surveys, one-on-one interviews, instant response, all sorts of different research techniques, I learn the words that work, and then I apply them in a political realm, public affairs, corporate, sometimes national, sometimes international, in trying to explain the way Americans feel and to, in some cases, motivate them to feel a certain way.
Now, let's get to what makes some of your work very controversial, and that is the words that you recommend or that you promote in promoting certain policies or legislation. So let's, for instance, look at the expression death tax as a substitute for estate tax or inheritance tax. Now, did you coin death tax or just recommend that Republicans use it?
There's really not much I've coined. I'm basically the Johnny Appleseed of language. I take the things that I find out that work from other people, and then I promote it because of my relationships in the corporate community and the political community. I've got a fair, large group of friends that are interested in explaining themselves as effectively as they can to the audience that they wish to reach. And so it's pretty easy for me to get language into the public lexicon. But an example like death tax, that came from polling. And what we found was if you call it the estate tax, about 50% of Americans want to get rid of it. If you call it the inheritance tax, it goes up to about 60%. If you call it the death tax, about 70% want to eliminate it. And the reason why is when you think of an estate, you think of the TV show Dallas or Dynasty. You think of Donald Trump or Ross Perot. And that's not something that as many Americans have sympathy for as the idea that if you die, your beneficiaries, your heirs, end up having to pay a tax. More and more Americans believe that a family being taxed at death is something wrong. And my company and myself was involved in that process for the last 10 years to explain that the death tax was wrong.
Now, you know, your critics say that death tax misrepresents what the tax is in the sense that death tax makes it sound that like everybody who dies is taxed when it's really a tax on people who have an estate worth more than $2 million, which isn't like your average American by any means. So do you think that by calling it a death tax instead of an inheritance tax, that instead of clarity, you are actually misrepresenting what the tax is? Because that's what your critics would say you were doing.
Right. Well, Terry, let me ask you, when is the death tax, what is the event that causes the death tax to be applied?
No, but what your critics would say is
I understand, but the death tax,
I realize it only happens when you die, but it also
exactly.
only happens when you're passing on $2 million.
Exactly.
So in that sense, what's wrong with inheritance tax in the sense that inheritance implies that you're dying and other people are inheriting your money?
Again, I have to go back to the same answer. It may not be interesting to listeners, but it is accurate. And that's the key to what I do. Everything I do in terms of language has to be accurate. It's to those who believe in clarity And one of the things I would very much encourage listeners to do is to read George Orwell's essay on language. The average American assumes that being Orwellian is a negative, that being Orwellian means that you mislead. If you read on language, to be Orwellian is to speak with absolute clarity, to be succinct, to explain what the event is, to talk about what triggers something happening, and to do so without any kind of pejorative whatsoever.
Now let's look at another phrase that you recommended. You recommend that Republicans talk not about drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Preserve, but rather energy exploration.
Absolutely. And I'll give you the example. When I say to you drilling, most people, when I ask them that question, they come up with two words, oil wells. And if you ask them a little bit more, they think of the black stuff that comes out of the ground that looks like Jed Clampett in Beverly Hillbillies. And the difference between drilling versus exploring, when you ask them about exploring, it's more precise. It's more 21st century. It's cleaner. It's more careful. If you know what a well looks like in Anwar, you know that our vision of it is much closer to what we perceive exploration would be than it is drilling. There are no oil wells. 98% of the exploration happens underneath the ground. And in fact, when you're done, when they've tapped out or they couldn't find anything, there's a small pipe that sticks out of the ground that's only a couple feet tall, and that's the only evidence whatsoever that any kind of exploration took place. And in the research I did, when I showed people what it actually looks like in Anwar, here's a picture. This is an actual site. I didn't use the word exploration. This is an actual site where they're looking for oil. Does this define drilling or exploring? Almost 90% said that looks like exploring to me rather than drilling. Therefore, I'd argue that that is a more appropriate way to communicate. I know the environmentalists don't like the language because they understand the impact. But if the public says, after looking at these photographs, that doesn't look like my definition of drilling, it looks like my definition of exploring, then don't you think we should be calling it what people see it to be rather than adding a political aspect to it all?
Well, I guess, what about, like, should we be calling it what it actually is as opposed to what somebody thinks it might be? And the difference between exploration and actually getting out the oil, they're two different things, aren't they?
I would argue that even just in this conversation now, if I were to ask you where you stood, and I won't, on Anwar, I can tell you by your definition. And that's also part of what I do is to understand what motivates people, where they come from. You have a certain preconceived notion of what should happen up there, and therefore your language is applied to that notion.
Well, I'm playing devil's advocate with you because I know the work that you do is controversial, and I'm trying to represent some of the reasons why it is controversial so we can understand the controversy behind it.
And I understand that, but again, I go back to, if 90% of Americans, 88% to be precise, look at a photograph and say, that's exploration, that's not drilling, who am I to say it's drilling? Is that fair?
You used the word environmentalist before. You've recommended that Republicans not use the word environmentalist, but rather conservationist. What's the difference in the way those two words poll?
It's actually kind of sad because the environmental community has developed over the years an image of being extreme in how they promote their efforts. I myself care considerably about the quality of air and the quality of water. And I believe in open space. I worked very hard for an initiative to set aside open space in urban and suburban areas that I know some people on the Republican side would not appreciate. And I have taken a role for the Nature Conservancy, as an example, in some of the efforts that they do. But the environmental groups, the ones that are best known, because of their language and the way they carry out their politics, have developed a very extreme image to them that has an impact of undermining exactly what they're trying to do. A conservationist is seen as someone in the mainstream. An environmentalist more often is seen as someone who is more extreme.
But could you argue that the reason why environmentalists are seen as extreme is because some conservatives have described them as extreme for so long that they started to be seen that way? In other words, you said that environmentalists developed an image of being extreme. You could argue that it's not that environmentalists like the Sierra Club are extreme, but rather they were smeared as being extreme.
I got to ask you again. Is tying yourself to a tree
extreme? But that's not in the mainstream of the environmental movement.
But those things happen, and people see that because it's visual, and they're trying to make a statement. Okay, let's do something a little more mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
If you are opposed to any kind of building, I just bought a place in California. I happen to like the weather out there. The environmental community basically stands up and opposes every opportunity, every program to try to build affordable housing. To them, any kind of additional construction, they will oppose. The American people don't support that. They're looking for a balanced approach where we can maintain open spaces and still provide for a population that's growing. And what's the impact of that? Everyone knows that you can barely afford to live anywhere in San Francisco or Los Angeles because there isn't affordable housing. And everyone who would develop, everyone who would create affordable housing, they know that it's going to take 10 years of battles with environmental groups before they can build anything, so it's almost not worth it. And the public looks at the environmental community and feels like it doesn't make any effort to reach that mainstream approach.
But again, do you think that the public that did reach that conclusion perhaps reached it because that's what they were told by Republicans who wanted to portray environmentalists as extreme?
What about Democrats who want to portray all business people as evil?
Let's get to another phrase that you've consulted on, and you've recommended, instead of using the word global warming, you've recommended climate change. What's the difference in how they poll, and why did you recommend climate change?
People react to global warming in a slightly different way than climate change. Climate change is less, it creates less hysteria. Global warming is more intense, it's more emotional, it's quite frankly more impactful. Climate change is more thoughtful, more reasonable. Global warming causes people to divide. Climate change says, let's deal with the issue and let's see if we can come to an agreement.
There's a group called the Environmental Working Group that started giving out an award in your honor for people who thought that they were using like euphemisms to obscure the true meaning of a policy. What was your reaction to, I think it's called the Luncey Award?
It's another example, and they were trying to get publicity off of my name, and they were trying in an extreme way to try to distinguish where they stand. And it's another example of why I feel the environmental community needs a new group of strategists, a new group of advisors who attempt to take what they are trying to achieve, which is not just important, it's essential. Quality of life, air and water and space and the beauty of what our country offers and has offered for 200 years. These things are important, and it is, I think, a tragedy that so often they're trivialized by individuals who use the same skills that I use, but they use it to create language that's very divisive, that's polarizing, that's extreme. And then they lose the mainstream of American public opinion. I'm so often asked, why is the environment not a bigger issue in the public mindset in election after election? Why is it that we've had environmental issues now in this country for 20 years, and yet in no election in that time has the environment even come up in the top five? My answer is just, and I say to people, go look at who's leading the movement, because they're just not in the mainstream of public opinion. The American people believe in a lot of what these organizations advocate, but they don't believe in the way it's being advocated.
Well, let me ask you a question about work that you've done with a trade group, because you do a lot of work outside politics. And I don't think you suggested the word gaming instead of gambling, but you promoted the use of the word gaming instead of gambling for the casinos. What's the difference between gaming and gambling?
If you talk about gaming, you think about the restaurants in Vegas, you think about the nightlife in Vegas and all the entertainment, you think about the spas and salons. Gambling is about dice, and it's about slot machines, and it's about cards. Gaming is about the whole aspect of an Atlantic City experience, a Las Vegas experience. It's all those things mixed in.
But just in terms of what the language conveys, I mean, you're talking about the shopping and the hotels and the restaurants. Those aren't gaming or gambling. I mean, people who go to game or gamble do that. But does gaming describe the hotels any more accurately than gambling does?
It's all in the perception. By the way, it's about 28-29% of Americans will at some point in the next year do either a lottery or go to a casino, will do some sort of gaming. For them, there is a difference. And my job is to listen to those who engage in these kinds of activities and be best able to respond to them, knowing that there are those who are critical who don't.
Bill, let me just ask you. You talk about the importance of clarity and that your job is about clarity. The difference between a game and gambling, technically, is that when you're gambling, if you're gambling on a game, you're placing a bet. There's money on the table. There's all kinds of games that don't involve gambling, but the ones that do involve gambling are called gambling, and the casinos are all about putting money on the table. That's why they're called gambling. So is calling it gaming clarifying, or is it just a kind of more neutral or even euphemistic phrase? Because for a lot of people, gambling seems, illicit. It seems, like there's compulsive gambling. It has like a negative connotation to a lot of people.
And that's the amazing thing, is that gambling actually doesn't have a negative connotation to most people anymore. It did, you're correct, 30 or 40 years ago. But it just doesn't anymore. The average American sees nothing wrong with Las Vegas. And in fact, even those who don't like the gamble still enjoy going out there for a weekend. And here's what's interesting. For the 20-year-old, and you ask the issue of gaming, what do they think of? They don't think of Las Vegas. They don't think of casinos. They think of those video games that the kids are now playing. So the definition has even evolved over the last 10 years beyond a slot machine, and it's now about an auto or a guy walking through a city, or there's got to be a better way to explain it. Now gaming to a young person is the video game that they play on their home computer, on their laptop, or even on their cell phone. So gaming has taken on a completely different meaning to the next generation.
So you're suggesting that when promoting casinos, the word gambling and not gaming should be used, because gaming, it means like computer games and things like that?
No. Gaming, I don't know when the last time you were in Las Vegas, but you will spend less time at a table than you will in the spa, than you will at a great restaurant having an amazing meal cooked by a world-renowned chef, than you will seeing the Beatles in Love, or Tom Jones, or Justin Timberlake, or whoever happens to be performing. And Debbie Reynolds is still there, and Wayne Newton is still there, so you still get a sense of the old Vegas. But it's people don't just go there anymore to sit at the tables. And gambling is such a small component of what makes Las Vegas tick.
Now, I want to ask you about a word that President Bush is using. And I don't think you've advised him on this, but I'm really curious about your take on the use of the word surge, as in he's advocating a surge of troops in Iraq.
I don't think it's an effective word, because the word surge suggests numbers, and more troops in Iraq will clearly be opposed by a majority of the American people. He would have been much better off talking about a reexamination of where we stand in Iraq, a reassessment of the specific components of troops, what they do, how they do it, and how many are needed, and then a reassessment and a realignment that puts troops, the number of troops, where they need to be in the process that they need to be waging this effort. I think he would have been more effective with those re-words, those R-E dash words, reassessment, refocus, because that suggests flexibility. It suggests listening to the commanders on the ground, and it suggests a focus and doing what is required in the field rather than just a simple focus on troop movement. And I'm going to give you another example because it relates to this. This administration talked about electronic intercepts when it first promoted the Patriot Act. And then over time, they started to talk about wiretaps and still later on, eavesdropping. Now, all three mean the same thing, but they have a very different impact. Eavesdropping is something that you do when you're listening to your neighbors arguing in the house across the road. Wiretapping is something that happened in Watergate, or it's something that the FBI does against the mob. Electronic intercepts is scientific, it's state-of-the-art, and it's applied in more of a national security feel. I don't think this administration focuses as much, and I know that I'm always being suggested that I'm advising the Bush administration. I have not seen the president in, I guess, 3 years now, and I've not spoken to anyone high up in the administration in a significant time. And I was never their pollster. I was never their language guy. But it's easy. It's a nice shortcut in op-eds and on the web and in blogs to suggest that my language becomes the administration's language. I actually believe that this administration is not effective when it comes to communicating. And one of the reasons why they were so ineffective in 2006, and one of the reasons why Republicans lost so badly, and one should not underestimate just how badly they lost, is that the American people not only became tired of the policies, but they also became tired of the communication. And this word surge is not going to help this administration over the coming weeks and months.
As somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about language and how it's used to promote ideas and policies and positions, I want to ask you a question about talking points. And the question will actually start with a clip from Jon Stewart's show. And he was talking at this point, this was like during the 2004 presidential campaign, and he was talking about how conventional wisdom is arrived at. So here's what Stewart had to say about conventional wisdom.
Conventional wisdom is the agreed upon understanding of an event or person. John Kerry's a flip-flopper. George Bush has sincere heartland values and is stupid. What matters is not that the designation be true, just that it be agreed upon by the media so that no further thought has to be put into it. So how is conventional wisdom arrived at? For instance, let's take the example of the addition of John Edwards to the Democratic ticket. I don't know how to feel about that. I don't know what it means. Here's how I will.
This is 28 pages from the Republican National Committee. It says, "Who is Edwards?" Starts off by saying a disingenuous, unaccomplished liberal. We also saw from the Bush-Cheney camp, they had released talking points to their supporters.
Talking points. That's how we learn things. But how will I absorb a talking point like Edwards and Kerry are out of the mainstream unless I get it jackhammered into my skull? That's where television lends a hand.
He stands way out of the mainstream, way out of the mainstream.
That stands so far out of the mainstream
that he is out of the mainstream.
Or out of the mainstream is well out of the mainstream.
I'm getting the feeling. I think they're out of the mainstream. Talking points, they're true because they're said a lot.
Now, since you work with language, I'm wondering if you've worked a lot with talking points and with getting people to be on the same page so that they're saying the same thing through the day, you know, repeating it until everybody kind of hears it so much that it becomes, as Stewart put it, conventional wisdom.
That's primarily what a FLAC's responsibility, and a FLAC is a euphemism for a press secretary or communications director. And I tend to work on the outside. My job tends to be figuring out the words that work, and then others take that language and apply it to the political situation or the corporate situation. What Stuart was saying has very much a core of truth to it, which is that if something is repeated enough, people will come to believe it. And the more you repeat it, the more believable it becomes. I remember watching in 1994 Newt Gingrich, who, regardless if you like him or dislike him, you have to acknowledge that he is one of the brightest political people that has come upon entered into politics over the last 20 years. And here is a guy who actually engaged the media and the American people in a discussion over Social Security, Medicare, budgets, taxes, education, perhaps most importantly, welfare, and how to bring people back into a productive life in American society. And yet Gingrich was demonized. From the very first moment that he became speaker, the so-called talking points, the effort against him, even when he was put on covers of magazines, the pictures were as unflattering as possible. And when people spoke about him, they used the most extreme language as possible. And you know what? It did have an impact. It had a very major impact against him.
Now, part of what you do is structure focus groups so that you can really test words and ideas and see whether they catch on, whether they connect to people. Can you talk a little bit about what makes a good focus group, like how it needs to be divided, what range of people and opinion you need on it for it to be effective?
My sessions are the loudest, most boisterous, most intense sessions of anyone who does what I do, because my job in all of this also is to get what people actually feel and not just what they want to say. It's very hard to get people to acknowledge that they have racial bias or that they have some sort of ethnic bias or that they're not open-minded when it comes to politics or that they may choose a product because they really like the advertising. These are things that people don't want to admit, even though it exists in day-to-day life, and we know it exists. We know that people don't look at products evenly. We know that they don't look at other people evenly, that there are different expectations and responses based on what you wear, what gender you are, what religion you are, what race you are. And so I have to break all of that down if I'm to get how they really feel. And very often I do that with humor. I do that with intensity. And my groups, and I do a lot of sessions in the New York area, which is the toughest. I feel sorry for anyone who's got to moderate a group in New York.
Because people are so cynical there?
They're cynical and they're angry and they don't mind telling you and they really don't listen to each other.
Uh-huh.
And it's just incredibly hard. And I've got to get my juices going before I do a New York group because I know that it's going to be the toughest 3 hours of the day.
I'll tell you, I was once involved in a focus group. We were testing something. And so I was on the other side of the one-way mirror, of the two-way mirror, so that, you know, we could see the focus group, but they couldn't see us. And there was one guy who got up in the middle of the focus group and came toward the two-way mirror with his kind of fists raised and started saying, "I know you're behind there. I know you're there." And it was bizarre because, of course, they knew we were there. But, of course, everyone was supposed to act like they didn't know we were there. Does that ever happen to you where people suspect that you and the other guys are on the other side of the two-way mirror, but they're supposed to act like you're not? Well, actually, you're organizing the focus group, so you're with the group. But there's probably other people on the other side of the two-way mirror.
There's almost always people watching, and they know it. But within 10 minutes, I do a lot of stuff on air, and I've done these focus group sessions on television for almost every TV network, not just in America, but I've done it for a number of – I've done it in Britain, Ireland, Israel, in public for their national TV networks. And the process is to get people to forget that there are cameras or in a traditional focus group to forget that there's a mirror. And if you're good at engaging them, they stop looking at the mirror and they only look at you or each other. Now, I had a situation similar to yours, but it was very tough. It was in Pittsburgh. It was with working class Americans, and they were very angry at the company that they worked for. And the intensity of that anger got so bad, and it was in a small room, and the room was packed with participants. I was backed up against the window. And a couple of these guys stood up and were threatening. And I didn't know. There was no place for me to go. I couldn't get around on the sides. And for one brief moment, I was afraid that the participants might put me through the window. It's the only time in doing a session that I've ever actually been afraid for my physical well-being.
So did all of this anger register on the people on the other side of the two-way mirror? Was this like a corporate testing thing?
It was a business testing thing, and the people behind the mirror got it. Oh, boy, did they get it. Mm-hmm. And I almost always bring my clients because I want them to hear how their customers, how their consumers, how people that they wish to relate to. I want them to hear if there is anger. I want them to hear if there is love. I want them to hear all of these emotions in the way that people communicate it, because I don't want to be the translator of it. I merely want to be the facilitator that helps corporations, trade associations, foundations better relate to the people that they wish to reach out to.
Now, you use something called the instant response dial or the people meter. What is the dial and how do you use it?
I want the listener to imagine something about the size of a remote control. It's a box with a dial, and it goes from 0 to 100. You turn the dial left or right based on whether you agree and believe in what you're hearing or whether you disagree or disbelieve. You're looking at a videotape of someone speaking, or sometimes it's the person there live, and the more that you agree with what's being said or the more you want to buy it, the higher you turn your dial. The more you disagree, disbelieve, or don't want to buy it, the lower you turn your dial. And you react to every word, every phrase, every aspect of that presentation, and we collect this. We'll put 30 people in the room, and we collect that information on the computer, and it generates lines that go up and down based on the words, the phrases, the presentation, and it tells us point by point, word by word, phrase by phrase, what works and what doesn't, what turns people on and off. And that's, by the way, how I learned immediately that the phrase, bring it on, that the president used in one of his press conferences was such a disaster.
What did people tell you when they heard it?
The lines caved. It even caved among Republicans who had voted for Bush. We tested the press conference. He's delivering a speech. It had something to do with AIDS. And then he reaches that line, and the lines drop sharply. There are several examples of this. Bill Clinton trying to explain what the meaning of the word is. Gary Condit trying to explain for the fourth time that he's been married for 29 years, that he isn't perfect, and that his marriage has had some ups and downs. Every time he said it, the lines went lower and lower and lower. That there are certain phrases and words that people use in their communication that just cause the listener to tune out and turn off. And Bring It On was an example, and I would not have known it if I didn't have that dial technology.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier in your career, you consulted to the Republicans who were putting together the contract with America. And this was 1994. And this was the contract that this was the document that helped Republicans gain control of the House in 94. What was your role in that?
I was I define it as the pollster of record. My job was to go out, figure out what was the best way to explain it, see that the items had public support, and I'll tell you a couple of inside stories. First, when we tested the idea of giving parents a $500 tax credit for a child, the response from the public was, that's not enough. I'm raising a child. I need more money than $500. So we changed the language to talk about $1,000 for a family of four, for two kids, which is a typical family of four. We didn't use the $500 number in the contract because it wasn't significant enough. It didn't seem like it would make a difference in people's lives. Another example, the two items
that
had
so you didn't change the amount of money, you just changed the language.
We change it to a family of four, we get $1,000. I'll give you again, if I tell you that Social Security begins to lose money in 2017, and I tell you that Social Security begins to lose money in 11 years, which to you sounds like it's sooner, it's more inevitable?
To me, 11 years sounds sooner.
Exactly. And that's how most Americans look at it. And so it's not misleading, but it is putting it in a context that gets Americans to pay more attention to the fact that only 11 years from now, Social Security starts to lose money, whereas the Bush administration kept talking about 2017. That's an example of the work that we do. Mm-hmm. If you don't agree with that position on Social Security, I have no doubt that you will resent that way of communicating. But in the end, there's nothing dishonest. There is nothing inaccurate. And in fact, I'd say to you that corporations and trade associations and politicians have a responsibility to communicate in a way that makes it most likely that the public will support where they stand. If it's 11 years from now, and that's a better way to communicate it than 2017, then talk about 11 years from now.
You also consulted with Republicans during the impeachment of President Clinton. And
I hated that. I hated that whole process. I had to get up very early in the morning. I would drive down to Capitol Hill. I genuinely wanted the president to resign. I had issues about the actual voting for impeachment. I thought because the president had lied under oath, it had nothing to do with his behavior, in my mind, and everything to do with what he did with the Justice Department and how the president has to set an example for the rest of the country. If he lies under oath, then who's to say that anyone else shouldn't lie under oath? And it was very tense. It was very political. And it was one of the most horrific experiences to watch that whole process unfold.
You wrote a strategy memo for the Republicans during the impeachment process. And let me just read part of this because I'd like you to explain it to me. I'm not sure how to interpret this. You write that Justice Rehnquist, who is the Chief Justice then, should serve as the cover for all otherwise partisan decisions. If you want the Democrats to appear defensive, negative, and partisan, you need to pit them against the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the symbol of impartial justice in America. This requires that Senate Republicans remove themselves completely from the decision-making process prior to the beginning of the trial. Rehnquist, not you, should rule on the Gorton-Lieberman proposal. Let Rehnquist make all the tough, controversial decisions. Is that making the assumption that Rehnquist would always, that the court would always rule in the Republicans' favor?
Oh, no way. But what it was saying is that Republicans should stop being and there's a phrase for this, jurors, judge and jury, I think is the euphemism that people use. At that time, the American people had begun to swing towards Clinton's side because they felt that Republicans were doing this not for principle, but for politics. And what that paragraph you just read said is, get out of the politics. If there is a legal decision to be made, don't talk about it because you're just politicizing it. Let the Chief Justice make his decision, whether he rules for the Republicans or rules for the Democrats. He will make that decision, and it is not for you as Republicans to play politics.
Then why did you use the word cover as someone so sensitive to language? You say that Rehnquist should serve as the cover for all otherwise partisan decisions.
That when he makes a decision, it will be regarded as impartial. It will be regarded as non-political. Let him make that decision so that you don't have to. Now, by the way, one of the things that was interesting was that it was okay for the Democrats to throw accusations and barbs at the Republicans. And I can remember for a whole year, people like James Carville just ripping into the GOP for accusing them of making this up, only to have to backtrack. And he never actually apologized, only have to backtrack after Bill Clinton admitted that the stuff that he denied doing, he actually did. And the problem that I have in studying this and being involved over the last, I guess it's 15 years now, is that, and I hate to say this because I don't like the consequences of it, but there is a double standard. That environmentalists can say what they want. I'll go back to that point. That environmentalists can say what they want about the business community, the people who employ tens of millions of Americans, and that's okay. But the business community can't say something about the environmentalists, that's out of bounds, or it's partisan, or it's negative. That it's okay to trash somebody like Newt Gingrich, but it's not okay to challenge Tom Daschle or now Nancy Pelosi. I really do believe, in listening as I do, that there's a double standard in communication. And one of the challenges that we need to face over the next, and this is a great way to head towards a close here. One of the challenges that we need to get conservatives not just to watch Fox News, but to read the New York Times and the Washington Post, to collect information from people that they don't naturally agree with. And we need people on the left on occasion to watch Fox News. We need not just to verify and to confirm what we already believe. We need to spend a lot more time listening to those who we don't necessarily agree with. That's how we're going to learn. And the purpose, the final reason why I went and wrote this book is that I wanted to open up the word laboratory so that people could take a look inside and be able to decide for themselves, is this honest? Is this fair? Is this legitimate? And the book was my way of trying to do that.
You mentioned Nancy Pelosi. You made news recently for language that you used, and this was in describing Nancy Pelosi. You said, you get one shot at a facelift. If it doesn't work the first time, let it go.
Yeah, it was a joke. And it was okay to make fun of the president. It's okay to make fun of John McCain or Rudy Giuliani. But if you're a Democrat and you make fun, if you crack a joke, that's not acceptable. See, that's what I don't understand. And that's something that I'm hoping that over the coming years we can address as a country. That if we are going to take things so personally, then let's make an agreement that we treat everyone the same, rather than saying that these people are okay to crack a joke about, but these other people are off limits. We really do have a double standard in this country, and it really does need to be addressed.
So you're not sorry that you said it? You have no regrets?
Oh, I have regrets because I've seen it. I Google and it comes up, and every single website on the left brings it up. It's almost every other day I see that quote. It was a joke. It was what I will surprise listeners. And even though I know the actual political, because I've polled NPR listeners, I have a lot of friends on the Democratic side. And in particular, I know a number of the Democratic presidential candidates and a number of the Democratic senators and congressmen. And they all laughed. They all thought it was funny. The people who don't find it's funny, and these are the people that I feel sorry for, are those who write in the blogs. There is an anger on the web that is so apparent, that is so personal and so vicious. And I don't see anything happening to address that level of anger. But there's no reason to have this this separation so that the only people that Democrats get their news from are those who they think have their bias. And the only people that Republicans get their news from are people who have that bias. We need to share more ideas. We need to have more discussion. We need to have more words that work for everybody, not just those on the left or the right.
Frank Lutz, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Pollster Frank Luntz is the author of the new book, Words That Work.